Gentlemen, thank you all for agreeing to being on this panel. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'll ask you to introduce yourselves shortly, but all three are the types of people, if you're a young emerging manager, you need to attract. There's a mixture of family offices and endowments who invest actively in young managers, also older managers. And so I'm super excited to hear the discussion which is going to come up. I'm going to start off with a few questions like usual, and then it will be over to you to ask your questions. We're running a tiny bit late, so I might overrun a little bit. Typically, I try and finish at 12 noon, so it might be closer to maybe 5 past or even 10 past. We'll see how the discussion goes. And then everyone can hopefully head off into the mountains because the weather is glorious once again today. So I'll start with asking each of you to introduce yourselves. Any volunteers to go first? Or thank you, Sergeant. Oh, Jason. Jason's going to go.
Sure. I'm Jason Mance. I'm the CIO at GHR Foundation. I'll give you a little bit of background. First of all, thank you for this event. It's a really special event. I'm glad to be back for the second time. I've been at GHR Foundation for about 7 years. It was a new effort, so a new investment office. That's the second time I've done that. Before I was at GHR, I was at Carleton College for about a dozen years and was their first investment hire and built out that portfolio. I've been in this allocator role since about 1998 or so. Before Carleton, I spent a couple years at an investment consulting firm working on equity strategies, and then I spent 5 years at a large pension fund. So that's a brief background.
Thanks also for the great event, and thanks for having us between the women panel and the skiing. So it's a bit tough for us, but let's do the best. I'm Thomas Brechtenbreuter, CEO of a Munich-based family office, at the family office for 15 years now. Worked for Accenture in a pension fund before and took over the CEO role 3 years ago. And we invest globally across private equity, public equity, absolute return, and a tiny fixed income allocation. And yeah, try to be a really long-term investor and always aspire what the US endowment model is and was, and kind of I really try to pitch ourselves as being the diversifier to a U.S. endowment-heavy investor base.
Thank you. Sergeant McGowan, I help manage the endowment for the University of Virginia. I've been there for about a decade, and prior to that, I was a fund manager for a firm called Invesco in the U.S., helping to manage a global equity fund. At UVimco, we're about $13.5 billion. We have a pretty traditional kind of portfolio, about 45% privates, about 25% in public equity, long only, long bias public equity. That's a strategy that I lead, and kind of the rest spread across credit, fixed income, and a few other strategies. And yes, we have a pretty approach in our world in the endowment space tend to be very long-term. Nearly all the capital is invested with external managers and within public equity, within that kind of 25% sleeve that's spread across maybe 15 to 20 relationships.
Great, thank you. Do we have one more microphone? Is there a spare one around? Or because in the last panel, everyone had their own microphone. Oh, just there, great. Is that working?
Test.
Yeah, great. Good. So thank you all three of you for introducing yourselves. So you all have probably interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of managers over the course of your career. I'd love to hear, and I'm sure perhaps as an organization you have your criteria, but as individuals you've also certain things you kind of look out for. I'd love to kind of ask you to speak to both of those points. So perhaps from a sort of more from a kind of your organizational perspective, what you're looking for, but maybe also some insights of what you personally look for in an investment manager. Do you want to go first, Sergeant?
Yeah, sure. I think at the highest level, there are a couple things that we're thinking about. Because we're investing with external managers, we don't tend to have a lot of turnover in the portfolio. The two big questions we're asking ourselves in really every meeting is, can we understand why a manager has and should be able to generate kind of excess returns over the long term. And that's, as we all know, that's the answer is generally no. So we need to understand why it could be yes in this case. And then the second question is really around partnership. You know, this is someone that we're going to be invested with hopefully for a decade or longer. And so is this a person, a team, a group that we feel comfortable with and want to be partnered with for the long term? I guess just to the second piece, you know, the things that we're thinking about or that I'm thinking about when sitting down with a manager for the first time is really understanding, you really just, you want to see that passion for what they're doing. I think this group and you know, Rob, certainly you and the people that you've attracted in your network, that's not, you're not short on that, right? There are a lot of people who are that are really kind of doing this more to make a living and to make money, and that's fine, but that's not necessarily what we're looking for. So that passion, and then understanding how their investment philosophy and what it is they're looking for, that can be expressed in many, many different ways. We try not to put people into, you know, tight of a box, but we do want to understand what that philosophy is.
Awesome. It fascinates me, that answer, just to briefly interject, that you're really looking for transparency to understand, you know, what the portfolio is, how the alpha is generated. Because I remember when I started out, funds, especially hedge funds, would be incredibly secretive about their strategies because they didn't, you know, they had this amazing money-making machine in their view, and they didn't want anyone to sort of figure out what the secret is. So it's fascinating that you not only look for transparency, but you value it. Thomas, maybe the question to you as well.
Yeah, for us, we kind of defined our gates. So that's kind of governance alignment, team execution strategy. So I think on the governance alignment, obviously skin in the game, being really partners for us long term, having one strategy, being really focused, do what you say you do, and really kind of have strong also aligned investors. Because for us, being a small investor, it's always hard if people run for the door at the worst time. On the team side, I think it's primarily character. So if you do the beer check and think, hey, do I want to have a beer or water with that guy at the evening? That's really a hurdle, because kind of there are going to be bad days and you're going to have to discuss the LPA or whatever kind of things going wrong. And you don't want to do that with people you don't like, and you kind of have doubts in the beginning already. So strong character is really important. And execution strategy is really kind of what's, like on the public side, what's your company? What's your focus? What are you looking for? Kind of, if you look through the portfolio and look through the 10 names, what is the common denominator and why do you invest? And that can be different things, but you have to have your strategy and focus and execution. I think it's not just track record, but really kind of how you execute on the strategy you put out in your pitch book.
And if I can pick up one point there as well, I love the idea of liking the people you work with. I think there's a school of thought, it's better if you don't like people, because then it's easier to become objective. But my experience as well has always been that, you know, if you like people, that's a very good indicator about their character and the potential for long-term partnership. So thanks for mentioning that. And Jason, over to you.
Yeah, sure. So I think the first thing I would say is I think it's just really difficult to select emerging managers. It's something that we're open to, we've done in the past. But I've been doing this for a long time, interviewed hundreds if not thousands, gone through diligence processes. It's so hard even to pick a long established manager with a good track record of alpha. I've been, you know, made mistakes and disappointed over time. You know, with an emerging market, you may not have that track record, or it's harder to suss it out. So maybe a few, and I think they echo some of the other panelists up here, but a few of the things that I look for is really a learning mindset. You know, we all make mistakes over our careers. I've made a ton, it's how I've learned. I try not to repeat them. Motivations are important, you know, it shouldn't be all about money. It's really difficult to suss that out, I think. So that motivation for wealth really has to be balanced. It can lead to suboptimal decisions that are not in the interest of your partners if that is too much of a motivator. Just really a ruthless focus on outperforming the passive alternative over an appropriate long-term time period, and designing your firm, your team, even your personal life to prioritize your ability to focus on investment performance. Ethics, integrity, valuing your partners. There's a school of thought, I've placed more value on, you know, liking and wanting to be with my partners. That's become more important to me. I've found that that's led to better outcomes over time. A focus really on what you can control, which is not market performance. So tending to worry less about beta and just more about what are my underlying companies and having a focus on that. Temperament, many can analyze a business and make good judgments, but you're going to encounter challenges. So how you react in your portfolio, how you react within your organization to your team, what's your temperament and how you handle those things. An ability to determine really what matters for a company in the midst of the flood of information out there. So that gets to just judgment and intellect as well. And it gets to what you said, but developing and articulating really a differentiated view in each of your portfolio companies and across your portfolio. And it is important to be able to articulate that to investors in a clear way so that we can really understand, so.
Yeah, and if there are two, I can pick out one point. I love your openness in saying, you know, managers in their first, second, maybe even third year, that's just in the too difficult bucket for me. And, you know, that's the message I've given to people is you shouldn't expect the money to start flowing in from day one. You know, the important thing is to give yourself enough runway to build your firm, to build your reputation, your track record, and then very likely in year five, six or seven, things will work out, but most likely not in the first year. Maybe two more questions I'm going to ask. The first one is, which I know is on a lot of your minds, but maybe too embarrassed to ask, so I'll ask it, which is people who would like to attract your attention as potential investors in their fund, should they reach out directly or should they wait organically until you kind of come across them? Maybe start with Thomas this time if you want.
I mean, we are not well known by design because the family thinks, well, if nobody knows, well, not that many people know us, it's kind of good for their safety. So there are not that many managers coming to us, so we have to find them. So it's hard to answer. Obviously, sometimes we are kind of jealous on the US endowments because they see everybody. They don't have to, they come to them. We have to find them.
Is that true?
For a billion-dollar foundation, no, it's not necessarily true. We're not Yale, yeah. So,
sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to see.
No, but so for us, I think it's not really the question because we have to find them anyway. So we are Munich-based, so it's not a hub. So
it wouldn't be a massive turnoff if someone were to sort of reach out to you directly.
It wouldn't be a turnoff, but kind of obviously, if you get a good introduction, that's kind of a better start than. So if you as a young fund manager, you can build from your network and kind of have the first investors starting from a network and get good introductions. I think introductions always help than getting a cold email. And you really have to differentiate yourself if you write an email because we get quite a few.
I can imagine, yeah. Jason, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I'd love to jump in on this because I have a strong point of view. The answer is yes, please reach out. We've been through this, we have pattern recognition. We can very quickly determine what interests us, you know, from a review of materials, whether or not we want to have a conversation. After a conversation, we can very quickly determine whether we want to move forward or not. So, and again, we're not well known either. I have a small team of four people. We really do focus, I welcome inbound inquiries to me or my team, absolutely. There are many institutions out there that are larger, that have a really supreme incoming deal flow. We welcome it.
Okay, I wouldn't want to be the one reading your inbox on Monday morning, but.
Sergeant, I can jump in on this too. Now, I agree with you, Jason. I think reaching out is always, actually one of the worst feelings is when you find someone that's already sort of built their business and we don't know about them. We pride ourselves on not having that happen. And so please do. We have an investment team of 15 to 20 people. There are two of us that are here today and we'll be around. So, we do appreciate those inbounds. It takes time. So, I think patience is a huge kind of send the email or reach out and then, be prepared it will take some time to get to know us and build that relationship over time. I think one of the things that is really helpful for us, if it is, kind of in your DNA and you like to write and you're good at kind of putting your words down on paper and writing letters, that is so helpful for us because it really does differentiate that kind of cold, email, because someone on our team will go through that letter and read it. And I think about yours is a little unfair. You'd been around for quite a while by the time we met you, but I had read all of your letters by the time we'd sat down with you, and so had my colleague Graham. And so, you know, it just made so much of a difference to be able to have that kind of underpinning, and it adds a lot to the kind of the foundation.
If I could just add to that, yeah, when you do reach out, please include materials or letters or anything like that so we can get that first cut and look at it. That's much more helpful than just sort of reaching out and asking for a meeting.
I agree. Like, if write down what you aspire and what you want to be and what you want to become, then obviously you get a much bigger chance of getting an honest reply from the allocator as well. Otherwise, it's just like.
I love the answer. I've just derived so much benefit from sharing my letters. And you know, even today, I still see people who are very secretive about their letters. They watermark them and all this kind of stuff. Especially when you're at the very early years, you're trying to draw attention to yourself. I can't emphasize enough how much it is to be transparent about what you do. Okay, one last question for me, and then I'm going to hand it over to the audience. And you might not want to answer this, which is totally fine. But are there any big sort of turnoffs which you would want to draw people's attention to?
I mean, I can think of one. It probably doesn't apply that much to this group because you all seem to be a bit more independent. Some people use kind of third-party marketers or people like that, and you just get hit over and over. So you know, we have a database. We know who people are. We try to keep track of it. Sending follow-up emails is fine, but you know, I don't need 10 a year. I think you know, there's a persistence level, but generally that does come from, you know, a more of a kind of a marketing arm of a firm, which again may not apply as much here.
I never even thought of that before, but that intrigues me. So you're going to share 50% of your economics with someone who's going to lower your chances of getting an investment. Sounds like maybe not someone I'm going to be investing my money with. Jason.
I might say for the type of manager that might be here for a, you know, a smaller shop, individual PM with a small team, there's probably less chance of a turnoff when you're outreach. I think it happens more in the larger firms or when you have a placement agent or, you know, a marketer that's reaching out to you in a larger firm that maybe hasn't listened to your feedback of, you know, I'm not interested in this strategy or that. I think it's probably just less apt in this type of investment manager. You know, that said, you know, being overly aggressive, I think is a turnoff for anybody, but yeah.
Great, thank you. Thomas?
I mean, maybe also accept the no. So like if you're not a fit, it's not a fit, and you shouldn't take it personal, but rather try to get honest feedback, because some people will just say, I don't know, we are over allocated to equities currently, which is not true because it's the easiest answer. So I think if you can get honest feedback, that should help you if it's an investor you really would like to have on your as an LP in your fund. And if he says no, just take it and accept it. And if he gives you a good answer, even accept it even more, because he's not going to change his mind by another 5 emails.
I think I would just say that's important too. For people that we do spend time with, or you know, we give a review of materials, we do really try to respond with something that says, this is why we're not interested, or it's not a fit for us at this time, or maybe later. But I think that feedback is important, and it's just fair to people.
Yeah, I think it's, sorry, yeah.
This slightly different angle on the same, but I think one thing that, from a kind of process approach perspective, we will do kind of day one investments. We will invest early with managers. We don't have a lot of turnover in the portfolio, so we don't have kind of an emerging managers program. We don't have a big book of this, but we will do it. We can be helpful, and we want to be helpful, even in cases where we're not investing. You know, there are, we can talk about that if we want to in some areas. I think the one place that, you know, you're kind of asking about turnoffs, we don't want to tell you how to invest. And so, you know, that's something that should be, you know, just rock solid, how you evolve and how that, manifests itself into a portfolio and what that looks like over time. That can change. You know, we're very open to all of that. But like that core philosophy of how you invest, I think a killer for people is if you if we sense sort of a, you know, should I be doing this or doing this, like, I don't want to answer that question for you. That's something you really need to feel and own yourself. And everything else we want to be helpful for, and we hope that we can be.
And I agree, kind of, you have to really know what you want to do before you start, because there will be bumps in the road. And if you come to the investor and say, oh, I'm changing my strategy now because I have that big lesson, so adjusting and getting better, definitely important, but kind of, I changed my strategy now because of that bump and I learned such a big lesson, that's tough. So you really find your strategy, find what you want to do and do it.
Yeah, I love the answers, and you know, in completely different contexts. Obviously, I don't interview investment managers, but you know, obviously, I interview service providers sometimes, and you know, it's emotionally awkward to tell someone you don't want them, you've chosen someone else, implying you think that other person is better. But it's a, you know, it's a matter of politeness and character to do it. And occasionally, the person, you know, I give that feedback to is then really sort of angry with me, takes it personally, and you're like, okay, I did something I didn't want to do, and I'm sort of in a worse place than where I was beforehand. Yeah, I would definitely echo that message. Even if it's a no, you should appreciate the feedback you get from that. Okay, is it okay to hand it over to the audience now? Great, I think we've got about 15, oh, actually even 20 minutes for questions, so far away. I can see Tim at the back there.
Hi, Tim Liu here. My question is, so when I talk to allocators, they often want to see a team of like multiple analysts and PM. And so for me, right now I'm just by myself, and I probably want to remain that way for the foreseeable future. And so my question is, how much of a turnoff is it to see a single PM, or like one-man shop, so to speak? And how much higher does the hurdle go when you see something like that? And then a different question, kind of echoing what Rob was asking the panel earlier, which is, how would you advise young managers to break through the chicken and egg problem where you don't have much AUM, and so a new check comes in, it has a lot of difficulty because it has to be below X percent of the fund, and then everyone runs, you run into that with many people, and so how many years of track record, or like what advice would you give to emerging managers for how to break through that? Thank you.
Okay, we'll split it into two, so maybe the one-man shop question first. What do you think about that? Who wants to go first?
I think people have different points of view on this. My main rule is I try not to overgeneralize and have hard and fast rules. I'm totally comfortable with a single PM with no team, and it's fine if you want to. You know, you may want to develop that over time. We've invested with people that are just single PMs that have built a team over time. Some people do have a different point of view. They do want to, you know, back. It's obviously a single PM, but you know, backing a team behind them. So it's not so much of an issue for us.
I mean, we like a bit broader team use usually, so we kind of, but we really like the single PM as kind of sole decision maker. Kind of, you have to be accountable, and you write a lot about it. Kind of, it has to be your decision. If you go for a bigger team, I think hiring also a COO, kind of taking off all the compliance burden initially, but and maybe also doing the first 15-20 minutes of your investor meetings with his really strong, might help you as well. So if you go for the route bigger team, then really hire a strong second person which you really trust, and we heard this morning, like, really it can really help you, and not, it's not another kind of burden who wants to be another founding partner of your business. It's you're the founding partner, but you have a strong lieutenant who's helping you on all the administrative burden, can handle some of the investor work, but you should still be kind of the main contact for your investors, I think, in the beginning.
Yeah, I think we're also open to lots of different structures. And so we have plenty of groups with large teams and plenty that have smaller, in some cases, really no teams. I think when it's just you, there are, you know, maybe two things to be thinking about. One is, what is your sort of sanity check? You know, I think for you, it's always been your network. But when things are, you know, going well or going poorly, and you need to be pushed a bit, you know, sometimes a team can help you do that. There are other ways to do it as well, obviously. But that's helpful for us to understand. We have this one person that's sitting here. You know, stocks move a lot. How are they handling that? What's the, you know, what's kind of the support mechanism there, and what's the sort of the pushback mechanism as well? And so that's something we want to understand, even if it is just a one person one-person team. And I think the other piece is understanding your expectation of what this will look like long-term. So it may be that this is what you'd like to have it just as a just you for the next 40 years, and that's fine. If you did want to scale it, you wanted to bring on a few analysts, like, we would want to see that you've thought about that and what you're trying to accomplish there.
Yeah, maybe just anecdotally before we go on to the second part of Tim's question, any sense of whether investment performance kind of correlates with team size, either positively or negatively, or it's just not a factor at all?
I mean, for there's probably, I think the adage in our world is that, you know, a certain level of AUM and certain level of team, and then things start to deteriorate a little bit. And I do think that that's probably true in some cases. What exactly that point is, I don't think, you know, one, two, or three is sort of the number of your team that's starting to like hit you into that spot. It's all very personal, right? So if that's how you work best, then that's what we want to see you doing. But, you know, I think you probably have a long runway on that one. In terms of not having to worry about that piece.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't have an answer for that. It'd be something good to look at. I mean, you know, there have been individual portfolio managers that have done a great job of adding value over time. But, you know, to your point, I do think it's important to have that check however you get it. But at the same time, you know, the reason that I'm comfortable without a team is because we really are seeking people that have independence of thought and do their own work and, you know, are the primary relationship with the companies in terms, you know, it's great to have an analyst to help you, you know, sift through things and increase your productivity. But at the end of the day, you've got to know everything. And, you know, one of the turnoffs is, you know, seeing too much filtering going on between a company and the ultimate portfolio manager.
I mean, for us, it's usually the end of it's a high hurdle to continue to invest when the head of research is hired. Kind of if you have like the analyst kind of reporting to the head of research and he's filtering to the PM, that's kind of, you have maybe too many people because you're not able to manage your people anymore. So you have a head of research. So if you think of that, you're either not hungry anymore or kind of you're having too many people, I think.
Such a fascinating answer, because I imagine a lot of people think, if I don't have like at least one head of research, six analysts and stuff, there's no point even bothering reaching out. And actually you're saying it's the opposite. So I love that response. And then the second part of Tim's question was like the sort of chicken and egg dilemma, that the perception I think of many young investment managers is like, without a track record, you're not going to attract the capital, but without capital, how are you going to start building a track record? So, you know, I know that's not your problem, but any thoughts you might have on that would be interesting.
I mean, I'll start, but it's not a very original answer because it's basically repeating your letter. I mean, I think that the ability to kind of be self-sustaining and focus on returns, you know, we all pride ourselves on being independent thinkers and not following the herd, and we do that sometimes. And so, you know, you'll get no for 3 years, and then you'll have 700 people that want to invest on the, you know, in the fourth year. And so, if you're performing well, and so I think, you know, head down, generate performance. If you write letters, send those around. I think events like this are great to network. To your point, you know, actually knowing someone when the email comes in and having met them makes a big difference. And just be patient. It takes time. In many cases for us, it will take us a couple years before we invest. Not always. That's not any sort of mandate, but it does work like that way sometimes. So I think focus on the things you can control and try not to build an organization that, you know, forces you to do something you don't want to do on the LP side.
I mean, it's hard. Don't want to be in your shoes. No, but I think it's really kind of, yeah, lining out what you want to do and convince investors by what you have done and what you're gonna do and show you're going back to showing what's your organigram in 5 years. So how many analysts you wanna have and kind of really showing the trajectory should help. And then it's like also we heard this morning, it's a bit of luck as well, I think, to be honest. You get the first good investor, big investor, he knows a few people, introduces you, they introduce you to a few. So I think that's unfortunately, the luck is also involved.
Yeah, I mean, I'd echo some of the same things. It is a difficult challenge. You know, there's a far smaller sort of group of allocators that are willing to take, you know, some risk. There's some business risk in that. But I think I'd go back to the comment, and I think here is just the ruthless focus on just outperforming in your portfolio and building that track record over time. You can do it on a small asset base. You know, at the same time, you know, having your thoughts out there, writing, so that really when you look back and you have outperformed, you know, you can really articulate that to people that you engage. We want to be able to see not that there's just outperformance, but how is it generated? Is it consistent with, you know, the materials that we looked at 3 years ago that you laid out? If it's different, and that's fine, why? But really a clear articulation of, like, how have we added value too?
Great. Who'd like to ask the next question?
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you very much for being part of this conference. And I'm going to take a little bit of advantage of you guys being there, invert to this. You're usually asking us the questions. go into your...
Revenge is a dish, as I've called.
No, but I'm sure you would agree that track record is a big part of what we do and how you sort of evaluate people. And so to that effect, it would be very interesting to know how many, let's say in the past 5 years, how many managers you have invested with, what the sort of initial allocation would look like. It obviously can be a rough estimate, 6, 7, 8 figures, and whether how you test them, whether you have some sort of lookup and you're like, okay, so I'll invest with you and it'll take 3 years before I actually evaluate you on a performance basis or not.
So on the public side, we do like 1 to 2 every year, and that's the same for the private equity side. So in addition to the re-ups, so it's like maybe we do 4 managers if it's a high velocity year or a high turnover year. So hopefully pretty stable, which helps once you're in the portfolio, obviously. And now I'm blanking on the second part. The time, sorry, and then kind of, so I think like giving, returning the capital to the manager after 3 years is kind of a big, has been a kind of a due diligence mistake, because so we want to be really long term. Obviously we give the manager 3 years and we have to understand what's kind of why they performed the way in the 3 years, and we are obviously, if you're invested, we're much closer. But it should be a partnership for 10, 15, 20 years, ideally. So 3 years is always a big disappointment, and we do it maybe once every 5 years, maybe, that we turn back capital that early.
Is it fair to say that would be less driven by performance and maybe more due to other things happening?
Yeah, so after 3 years, you don't know. So if you redeem due to performance, it's always kind of had been a mistake. Because you should redeem basically if the manager outperforms and you believe that's now the he's at the peak now. Yeah, there's maybe other things that we believe he's, well, team turnover or he's, maybe if it's a young manager, we see, think, well, it's maybe he's not like a great business builder or anything like that.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a balance here, right? So if you are doing 1 or 2 new things a year and you want to hold those things for 10 years, you actually don't leave a lot of room for emerging manager checks, right? Those are things you're going to want to be, you know, pretty certain on. And so we've tried to give ourselves a little bit more latitude on, you know, that would be sort of the general, you know, pace for us. We would do, and within the public equity strategy, maybe, you know, 2, 3 new things a year. If it's someone that's, you know, on the younger end, and the most recent one we did there was probably 2 years ago, we may start a little bit smaller. We may, you know, think about 3 years as a period where, you know, I agree with you, in most cases, if you're redeeming after 3 years, you've made a mistake, something's gone wrong, and it's not generally for performance. But for newer managers, we might do, you know, smaller checks, a few more of those, and then have this kind of 3 to 5 year sort of up or out, right? Like, we just, it's a little bit more of a test case. And so we've tried to take that approach, because otherwise you just get yourself in this box where you almost just exclude emerging managers altogether, because the bar is just so high and you don't want to be coming out after 3 years. So we'll do a little bit of that on the emerging side.
Great.
Hi, I'm someone that sits somewhere between the emerging managers and what Rob does, so I've had a bit of experience of meeting different sort of allocators. So one, I'd echo what Tim said at the back in terms of you get quite conflicting feedback about you've not got a big enough team, you've got too big a team, you've not got enough people in compliance, that sort of stuff. So it's really interesting getting your feedback on that bit, because it's never the same. Be really interesting to get the same discussion on structure and regulation. So I'm FCA regulated, I run a UCITS fund, but then you might go and meet someone else that says, well, you know, we need you to have an offshore fund, or you're not SEC registered or whatever else. So how important is it from your end that the person's already got the right structure? Or would you just like to speak to people who are good managers, and then you'll worry about the structure somewhere down the line? Because that's the other thing that comes, is you get a bounce back depending on your current structure or your current regulation.
Is it okay if I respond to that one?
Yeah. Love to get your view too.
Because I feel quite passionately about this. I don't think any structure should be based on what you think somebody else wants. That the structure should really be based on what do you need to put in place to beat the market. And then if you do that, you know, things will come later. Now, obviously, from a legal perspective, if it's a certain type of fund, not everyone can invest in that. So that's a consideration later down the line. But, you know, the first and foremost, you know, you shouldn't be canvassing an opinion on how many team members you should have or that kind of stuff. It should be based on what you think you need to be successful. But I'll let you guys respond as well. Sorry, I just had to jump in there.
I mean, maybe on structure as well, like UCITS is kind of, we really don't really get it, kind of why UCITS. We have to do our diligence. We don't need to be protected by the regulator, we believe, or otherwise we missed our job. So it reduces your discretion and your freedom. So it's rather the investors who want to go out more quickly. So you might attract the wrong investor base. So it's rather like a negative selection on the UCITS side, maybe for us, because we think wrong investor base, not that long term. We have to take care of the asset liability match in your portfolio. But except for that, it's the second step, looking at the structure.
Jason? I would say we don't really run into this issue that much. I mean, we've got to have a legal structure that in which we can invest. It's important to us. But I'd be hard, we haven't invested in a UCITS fund and probably wouldn't. I mean, I'm not as deeply familiar with that structure. But we generally just haven't had an issue. The people that are approaching us, we can find, they either have a structure set up or we can find something if it's something we want to do.
I agree.
Not much to add on that.
Who wants to ask the next question? Claudine?
Hi, thanks. I had a couple of questions on how you judge a good process or a good philosophy. So how much transparency do you like to see or want in terms of what's in the portfolio, the changes that have taken place, and what's driving returns? So over time. So I often wonder whether, you know, institutions would have invested with Warren Buffett with the kind of information he gave at the beginning in his partnerships, which is very little apparently. And the other question is related is the power law. What happens if you have a fund that's very concentrated and they make the money and two stocks and eight stocks are doing nothing? I mean, do you want to see that most of their decisions are good or are you happy? No, they just make the returns. It doesn't matter. So I guess a way of judging risk of the returns.
I'll start there because we think a lot about this and it's really important to us. So the more data that we can see, and we're very confidential about it and happy to sign anything, but the more data we can see, the better. A manager can tell us anything, you know, we can look at, straight line performance versus a benchmark. That really doesn't give you any insights at all. So we need to go much deeper. I think it's something that, one, there's more tools out there. We've gotten a lot better at it. I've evolved in my career. It's one of the learnings that I've had. So we do have the tools to look at. You know, we'd like to have, you know, quarterly holdings at least to be able to look at your track record and find out where the value is coming from and what deviations you're taking from the index. The power law question is a good one because I have analyzed managers. And you do have to go deep to do this. It's not something I necessarily did earlier in my career. You could get at it sort of qualitatively. Again, I try not to make hard and fast rules or generalizations. So we have invested in those managers. We identify it as a risk in terms of like, hey, a lot of the value here has been created by one or two companies that they've invested with. There might be, you know, a bunch of others that have not done so well. So as long as we have knowledge going into that and, you know, we make an informed judgment on whether or not we want to invest, I'm a little bit less concerned. I mean, it'd be great to have, you know, sort of positions contributing across the board, but sometimes it's just not like that. So it's really sort of we want to have the quantitative information and then ultimately we'll make that qualitative judgment.
Yeah, I think it also depends a bit on the strategy. So in broader portfolios, so in a long short portfolio that may have more names than the long side and short side, certainly in things that we would do in like an absolute return space, you do want to see that hit rate. I think this world is a little bit different of concentrated public equity. You know, I would just agree with Jason. If we just need to know that. In some cases, maybe we need to think about it almost more like a co-investment, and then we just need to size it appropriately. So if that thing runs 200%, we should probably be just trimming it a bit, right? Or maybe not, but we should be thinking about that at least, right? And so we're comfortable with it, but obviously, you know, all things equal, you'd like to see a few more wins than just one.
I mean, I agree. If the manager is in the portfolio, it's okay if we have two outperformers and they make a lot of the outperformance. If you do due diligence, I think the more outperformance you have and the broader it is, the easier is it for us, at least on paper, to kind of have luck and skill, understanding what's luck and what's skill. So if you have like one hit, it's kind of, well, was it luck or was it skill? And on the transparency side, I think, yeah, the more the better is always kind of the obvious answer from investors, I think. And for us, I think it also helps you to understand what's going on in the portfolio. You can kind of track the performance also intra-month and kind of you're not negatively surprised at the end of the month. So we don't care about monthly returns, but just like, you know what's going on, you know what's in the portfolio. You can follow the companies, you can have more educated questions, hopefully, with the managers, and that helps a lot. And we hope, being that close, that we should know the portfolio anyway. And they're all long-term investors, so there shouldn't be that much churn that it makes a big difference if you send us the names on a quarterly, maybe a quarterly lagged basis, or but can get a feeling of the portfolio.
Just on that point, I think, yes, more is better. I think a little nuance on our end on that. A lot of our initial meetings with managers, you know, we're spending time trying to understand them. And you asked, I think, the motivation question earlier. I think that's a really important piece, and that's something we're trying to get out of those meetings. When it comes to kind of process, approach, investment style, we really try to get at that through largely through discussions around portfolio companies in the portfolio. And so that transparency is super helpful in those initial meetings. If someone were to send us like, you know, 10 years of monthly returns and all the portfolio, you know, we've never met, we're not gonna probably do very much with that. So what we typically do is we'll do that first meeting. We may sit down afterwards and kind of, you know, put our heads together, you know, is this worth a little bit more work? And then we may reach out and ask for some of that more detailed information, but we would certainly want it, you know, earlier in the process.
And I agree, it's not like send us whatever you have, it's just we find something in our due diligence and want to know more about it, and then we ask you for detailed information. And if the manager says, oh, I'm not sending it to you, that's kind of more an issue than saying we're not sending you all information we have.
Claudine, did we hit on both parts of your question there? Great. We're slightly after midday, so if there is one last question, happy to take it. If not, we
Rob,
might start.
We could have a quick
up.
One from the internet, Rob.
Yeah, sure. Where are you?
To your left.
Here we go.
Sorry,
Nick.
Just quick question on cash levels. Those that don't you view on and fully invested or holding some cash, and those that hold cash, how do you judge how they handle that during different market environments, dislocations, etc.? If you have a view, you may not have.
Yeah, no, I think that also sort of falls into the personal style bucket. It is in a world where equity markets generally go up. If you hold, you know, 30% cash all the time, that's that's on you. You know, we need performance, and so you know, but if that's what makes you feel comfortable, we do have managers that do that. maybe not quite that high, but we do have managers that will hold cash. I think the one that we would be watching for even more closely is if you've presented yourself as a bottom-up fundamental investor in 8 to 10 companies, and then we see you moving your cash levels around because of, you know, macro situations in the world, that's a hard game. It's not, you know, so that's something we'd really want to kind of understand, if those things are really swinging around for sort of non, at least bottom-up fundamental reasons.
I agree, no macro views, not saying, oh, markets will go down, we're gonna have 30% cash. But if you say, well, I really, we don't find any ideas, it's just hard currently, then it's okay. And we also learned, if the manager knows what he does, and he did it for 10 years, and he has the 20%, and it makes him take more risk on the 80%, and overall, and he should invest all his money, and kind of overall, it gets to better performance. We shouldn't make him go to 100%. I think that's also some mistakes we also made, like pushing managers to things that's not in their DNA. So it has to be in your DNA. You don't make a benchmark hugger to a high conviction manager, and you're not making a person who loves to have 10, 20% cash to a 100% invested manager.
Yeah, I mean, I'd add a little bit to that. I think one of the good things about cash levels is that, you know, with a track record, you can look at how much it's detracted or added over time. And that is something that we would look at. I think my philosophy has changed a little bit on this too. You know, market performance is not something you control. We all keep reserves in our portfolio. We all want to be able to invest when prices fall a little bit. But it makes me, I'm much less to that. In fact, wouldn't do it now. If a manager tends to, you know, raise cash levels to 20 or 25% in anticipation of markets falling, that would make me a bit uncomfortable. I just really want you focused on the companies that are in your portfolio.
Sorry.
I wanted to answer a question from earlier, if I could.
Yeah, just, please. Yeah.
Not at the risk of holding everyone up from skiing. There was a question actually in one of the earlier sessions about, you know, kind of these meetings that you do with people like us kind of forcing you into, you know, into a box a bit. And I think, you know, when I reflect on some of our best investments and the best investors that we've spent time with, creativity is a really big piece of what has made them successful, I think, whether that's in the ideas that they find, or the way they do research. And, you know, that sometimes can be, you know, kind of hard to get into a PowerPoint presentation and hard for people to understand what you're doing. But just, you know, don't let us like squash the creativity, because if you can generate great returns with it and it's a real piece of who you are, I think it's really important on the other end.
Awesome. Well, we're a little bit after midday now. I promised we'd overrun a little bit, but I know it's a wonderful day out there and you all want to get out there. So all that remains for me to do is to thank my three panelists from today. And of course, Nir and everyone else who's appeared on stage here, and of course you, the guests, for coming along and making it the special event it is. So thank you to all of you, and I look forward to seeing as many of you as possible here in 1 year's time.